Hi, Human.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Yourself?
I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and you are Human Majd.
Correct.
Of New York at the moment.
New York, Brooklyn.
But you were born in Iran.
I was indeed in Tehran, yep.
And you've written books about Iran, including The Ayatollah Begs to Differ and The Ayatollah's Democracy.
Yes.
And the first of those titles, I gather, is a reference to some interactions you have personally had with Iranian officials, right, including two Iranian presidents?
Correct. One of whom is a mullah, the other one not. Ahmadinejad, the current president, not being a mullah. Yeah, I'm actually related by marriage on my father's side to former President Khatami. So that's how I met him.
He's the reformist who's associated with the Green Movement.
Associated, in fact, probably some say the leader of the Green Movement, given that the current leaders are in under house arrest. And he is under, not quite house arrest, but he's under pretty heavy monitoring right now in Iran, and is not allowed to leave the country, for example, and is considered the father of the reform movement.
Mm-hmm.
President Ahmadinejad, yeah, I have had interaction with him. Through my relationship with the previous president, I got to know many people in the administration who stayed on, like mostly in the foreign ministry, who stayed on after career diplomats who stayed on after Ahmadinejad became president. Through them, I met Ahmadinejad, and because I had accompanied President Khatami on his trip to the U.S. back in 2006 and had been pressed into service translating for him at the various speeches he gave at universities and other places, by pure accident, only because on the first day he arrived and we flew to Chicago to address the North American Islamic Conference, they suddenly realized they didn't have an interpreter for his speech.
For Ahmadinejad's speech.
No.
This is the first. This is for
Khatami.
Khatami. Okay.
So because he had asked for my help in preparing his speech, at least the English version of it, and we had an English version of it, we're sitting in the room, and he said, well, you can do be the interpreter. I said, well, my Farsi's not good enough, and it really isn't good enough, and I certainly have no expertise in translating. He said, no, it's going to be fine. You're going to be sitting right next to me anyway, so just listen to what I'm saying and try to keep up with me, and you have the English text. So I did that. Those speeches were seen in Iran and by some of Ahmadinejad's people, and they asked me if I would be willing to translate for him as well when he came to the UN. And I said, well, that's a curious thought, and even though he was very much anti-Khatami, I thought it was interesting. And I said to the Iranian ambassador here, who had asked me, the ambassador of the mission, I said, well, you know, say yes, I would be willing to do it as long as I'm free to write about it. And there's nothing is off the record in any of the meetings, in anything I do. And of course, I can't get paid and I don't want to get paid, for obvious reasons, foreign government and so on and so forth. And to my surprise, they said yes. So I did and wrote a cover story for the time. It was the New York Observer about it, and they did a big cartoon of it. And then, you know, he seemed okay with it, Ahmadinejad, but it led to interaction with him and his administration.
Hmm.
Now, that has changed over the years, and particularly after the elections of 2009, where things have gotten much more difficult for people who, like myself, are associated with the Green Movement or the Reform Movement. And so I don't really have that relationship anymore, although I have been invited to, you know, like other writers and journalists in New York, I've been invited to the lunches or, you know, afternoon teas or whatever President Ahmadinejad gives when he's here in New York, along with other American writers and journalists. But other than that, no, my relationship is not particularly strong with this administration.
Okay.
To put it mildly.
And a question I'm sure you've been asked before is, what is Ahmadinejad like?
Well, I've been asked that before. Yeah, he is not unlike a George Bush or any political leader who has been a survivor and has been able to, at least in his first term, get a lot of voters to support him, and I think even in the second term get a lot of people. Still to this day, he has quite a bit of support. I don't know if it's a majority. I doubt very much that it is, but I think there are people who really support him. He's very charming. and he can really be, you know, he can be the guy, you know, if there's an equivalent of the guy you want to have a beer with, let's say guy you mm-hmm. want to have a chai with in mm-hmm. Iran, he would be the guy because he's down to earth when you meet him. He can be very charming, self-deprecating. Mm-hmm. You know, he's pretty witty. And he certainly doesn't come across as evil in any way. Now, that's just an observation of a political figure who is a successful politician, not really a judgment on his character, because I don't think anybody really knows him that well. Mm-hmm. We know his public persona, and he obviously has. I know one of his good friends who's actually, oddly enough, somebody who went to school with him in Iran, who's oddly enough a reformist and very much against the conservatives in Iran, and he's a university professor. But he swears up and down that Ahmadinejad's a good guy. So, I mean, you know, you hear that from his friends, and, you know, it's like the...
Right. Now, you're familiar with the reasons that he comes across as evil to a lot of observers
sure.
In America and elsewhere, right?
Sure. I think particularly, I mean, you know, listen, I mean, the evil part is largely related to Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, which he's certainly guilty of, and some of his very wild and harsh rhetoric about the West. My argument has always been that some of that rhetoric is meaningless. It doesn't matter. His anti-Semitism, even to me, at least to most Iranians anyway, let's say not just to me, again, doesn't matter that much in the scheme of things. He's not the commander-in-chief, even if his anti-Semitism was at the level that he would want to be a Hitler and want to actually kill Jews and commit genocide, he has no control. He has no ability to do so. So I think it's a bit of a red herring to keep calling him. I mean, for me, Ahmadinejad has been absolutely the greatest gift to the state of Israel that they could have possibly hoped for, at least in terms of the propaganda that comes out of Israel. And at least for the people who want to believe, apart from the people who believe that Iran really is an existential threat to Israel, and it appears to me that not all Israelis agree, not even all Israeli leaders agree that it's an existential threat. But for those who don't believe it's an existential threat, he still is the greatest gift because he allows Israel to paint Iran as this horrific, horrific, monstrous regime, which it may be, by the way, to its own people, no denying that. But in terms of its wanting to be an expansionist regime, I think it's enabled the Israelis to portray Iran in a way that has deflected away from some of Israel's own issues, such as the Palestinian issue, and made Iran this big, big, big issue that the world has to pay attention to. And he has just continually reinforced that. Every anti-Semitic utterance by him or other people in his administration, and it's not just him, he's a vice president who said some pretty horrific things, or anytime he's mentioned Israel as a country that, whether however you want to translate it, as a country that shouldn't exist, as a regime that shouldn't exist, all this rhetoric has been an absolute gift to Israel in demonizing Iran.
Well, it's interesting that you've done a little translating for him and for another Iranian president, because in that regard, I mean, some things he said become, you know, translation becomes an important question. I mean, first of all, there's a famous I can't say it because in English, because the English translation is disputed. It's often rendered as wipe Israel off the map or something. Do you have a take on that one?
Yeah. I mean, in Farsi, again, my Farsi is not perfect. There are people who are better than me at translating word for word. First of all, he never used the word Israel. He just repeated what misquoted Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of Iran, a statement about Israel, which was the Zionist regime. I mean, if you wanted to translate it absolutely word for word, it would be this regime that occupies Quds, which is Jerusalem in Arabic. The regime that occupies Jerusalem will disappear from the pages of time. The Iranians themselves translated, at least one of the wire services, the Iranian translated as wipe off the map. Mm-hmm. And New York Times picked that up, and that went out everywhere in the world. It became that.
What do you think it meant in context?
I've been asked in other interviews, not just by me, but by American journalists, including Brian Williams of NBC and CBS News and ABC's, what does that mean? And he said, exactly like the South African regime, exactly like the Soviet regime. Those regimes don't exist anymore, and this regime will not exist anymore. The Zionist regime will not exist. Well, now, you could argue that that means that there won't be a Jewish state if it's not going to exist. So you can interpret it any way you like. He claims, at least he does, and his administration claim, that these regimes will not last. And, of course, Iran's position on Israel has always been, from day one, from 1979 on, from the revolution on, that there's a one-state solution. And that one state includes Jews, Christians, and Muslims who will decide on their future. Mm-hmm. That's not in keeping with what the Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, has agreed, which is that there will be a two-state solution. It's certainly in keeping with what Hamas believes, which is there's still only going to be a one state. There is going to be a state as a Jewish state. So, yes. One could argue about this for days. It's semantics, but whether Iran means that it's going, that Israel can never exist as a Jewish state, mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what Ahmadinejad would like to be the reality. Neither he actually, nor any other Iranian has ever in a leadership position has ever suggested that Iran would bring that about, militarily anyway, would bring about the
And he has revisited this, right? I mean, it's a kind of a common formulation of his. Here's another example. Again, this is the English translation from I don't know where. This is from a post by Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic. It has him saying, any freedom lover and justice seeker in the world must do its best for the annihilation of the Jewish regime in order to pave the path for the establishment of justice and freedom in the world. You're saying in his... If he were asked what that means, he would say same thing what you just said. I mean, this is a...
You don't have to believe him, but I mean, that's what he would say. And that's what he has said in the past, and I don't see any reason to believe that he would change that argument. And when he's here again in a month, I'm sure he'll be asked about it yet again. And once again, he'll say the same way the South African regime disappeared, the apartheid regime disappeared, and the same way that the Soviet Union, the communist regime of the Soviet Union disappeared, that's what's going to happen to Israel. That's what he's going to say. I'm saying that's what he's going to say.
Okay, so when people characterize this as eliminationist, I mean, in this case, Goldberg calls it, frankly, Hitlerian in scope. You don't think it's reasonable to interpret it as an aspiration to eliminate the Jewish people?
Well, I mean, it might be an aspiration to eliminate a Jewish state as a state.
Well, right, but...
But did you eliminate Jewish people? No, even, I mean, I can't remember who it was, but just very recently, some very senior Israeli, I think Army Chief of Staff, or it might have been a former Mossad head in Israel, just recently, a couple of weeks ago, said that in an interview that, you know, he didn't believe that Iran is anti-Semitic in that way, and he said if they wanted to start, there's 25,000 or 20,000 Jews in Tehran, they'd start right mm-hmm. there at home. He actually went on to say they actually are left alone and live their lives and nobody's bothering them, which is largely true. And I wrote a whole chapter about the Iranian Jewish community in my last book, The Ayatollah's Democracy. It's a complicated issue because it is, I believe it must be difficult, even though I'm not Jewish, it must be difficult for an Iranian Jew to have to constantly be aware of the fact that they can never, you know, show any kind of support for the existence of Israel, that they always have to be anti-Zionist. Certainly the leaders of the community, such as the member of parliament who's Jewish, has to come out. I'm not saying he's forced to, or, you know, a pistol's pointing at his head, but I mean, he feels, as the leader of the Jewish community, to stand up in parliament once in a while whenever Israel does something, like if it attacks Palestinian, like if it attacks Hamas in Gaza or something, come out and say something about the evil Zionist regime. So I can't imagine that it's easy, but I also know that compared to I'm not trying to make a moral equivalency, but compared to other countries in the Middle East, Iran's Jewish population have a relatively okay time. I mean, they're not hostage, as some people, like Jeff Gold continually says, and has said to me even on Twitter, that, you know, keep bringing up, that's a great propaganda tool, the Jewish community in Iran is a good propaganda tool for the government. They're being held hostage, or words to that effect. I don't disagree that they're a good propaganda tool for the Islamic regime, but I disagree that they're being held hostage. A lot of Jews I know who live in Iran have dual citizenship of other countries, U.S. included, and they travel all the time. And they even have, you know, homes in Beverly Hills. But yet they choose to live most of their lives in Iran, whether they're doctors, surgeons, businessmen. And if they really were hostages, you know, the next time they arrived in Beverly Hills or New York, they wouldn't go back, you know.
Okay. Now, you said that Ahmadinejad himself, I forget whether you said he definitely is anti-Semitic, or he definitely says anti-Semitic things, or exactly how you put it. But you're not denying that. And I guess one source of concern to Israelis who, even if they accepted everything else you said, would be that presumably, you know, he's playing to an audience. I mean, he's a politician. I mean, almost more disturbing than the fact that this one guy who happens to be president now is saying it is the fact that he's a politician who must understand that it has some resonance, right?
And interestingly enough, the resonance, it's not playing to an audience in Iran. He's not playing to Iranians when he says that, because, you know, if anybody goes to Iran or spends any time in Iran, they'll see that the Iranians really don't care that much about the Israeli or the Palestinian issue, by and large, the population. He's playing to an Arab audience, to an Arab street audience, and always has done since he became president. And his feeling has always been to promote Iran and promote himself and Iran as the only nation on the planet that stands with the Palestinians, stands against the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. Even before the Arab Spring, when all the other Arab countries were kind of like, you know, in the American, most of the other Arab countries other than Syria, were in the American orbit, and the people of the Arab world were very much against the policies of their regimes vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So you could say, look, we're the ones. We're the Muslim, you know, leaders. We're the leaders of the Muslim world because we still support our fellow Muslims. Your people don't. The Mubarak regime has relations with Israel. The Jordanian regime has relations with Israel. The Saudis deal with Israel at the time, are happy to deal with Israel. We're the only ones who stand up for the rights of the Palestinians. And that was, at the time, like Sheikh Nasrallah at the time also of Hezbollah, was very popular. There was a poll done in 2006 or 2007, I think, after the 2006 war, where the two most popular figures in the Muslim world in Egypt were Nasrallah and Ahmadinejad. And I think that's what he wanted.
Okay. Now, the other thing you said is that whatever his beliefs, he's actually not the most important person in Iran in terms of military terms, and that is the supreme leader. I haven't kept track of everything he has said. I'm pretty sure there are at least some things that are incendiary from Israel's point of view that the supreme leader has said as well, right? What kinds of things?
The use of the Israel is a cancer on the region and needs to be eliminated. Absolutely. There's no question that he has said some of the same things. He has also said, and not recently, but he has said in the past in relation to Israel, that the views of Iran haven't changed, but Iran will never be the instigator of any action against any other country, and he's included Israel in that. Again, you don't have to believe it, but compared to Ahmadinejad, at least, the supreme leader's rhetoric is not as harsh.
Although the last quote, you know, if I were Israeli, that would be a little alarming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A little alarming. Yeah. Now, whether you want to consider that pure rhetoric again, part of the Iranian foreign policy of showing Iran to the rest of the world. And again, not necessarily to a domestic audience, because it's very rare to see Iranians inside Iran, even the religious ones who support the regime, to be overly concerned with the Palestinian issue. We really, you know, the Palestinians are Sunni, mostly Sunni. Iranians are Shia. They're Arab. Iranians are Persian or Kurd or Armenian or whatever. They're not very few Arab Iranians. Mm-hmm. There has never been a long history of a sympathy for either Arab or even Palestinians. So this has been the Islamic Republic in the last 30 years. It's been its position to support their so-called Muslim brothers, the Palestinians, but it doesn't resonate in a big way. You can't find an Iranian family in Tehran or anywhere else in Iran who even knows any Palestinians. So it's very, you know, on any level, there aren't any Palestinian refugees in Iran. There never have been. It's an Iranian national policy, I mean, foreign policy, that has been continuing since 1979. And by the way, a lot of this rhetoric came from Khomeini as well. And we weren't that alarmed by it then because most people took it as being rhetoric and not much more.
Well, and Iran didn't have a nuclear program that was this close to being able to produce a nuclear weapon then. I mean, I think that's what's...
Certainly, that has been the... Yes, certainly. But, you know, even under Khatami, President Khatami, the reform president from 1997 to 2005, you didn't hear a lot, even though the Israelis have been claiming since the early 90s that Iran will be able to build a bomb in the next year or so. So that's been going on for over 20 years. But under Khatami, you didn't really hear this kind of alarm in Israel. And the things that the Supreme Leader would say then or people would say in Iran then were not that different from now, except they know nobody ever came out and continually denied the Holocaust and talked about wiping Israel off the map and talked about this and this. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess a final translation question or on this theme is, so has the Supreme Leader been as consistent as I think you're saying Ahmadinejad has been in referring to the regime when he says these things, as opposed to, I mean, the way you just put it, in the quote attributed to the Supreme Leader, Israel is a cancer that whatever. That's ambiguous. It may be the regime, it may be the people.
Neither the Supreme Leader nor any Iranian politician dares use the word Israel. They always call it the Zionist regime.
Okay? I see.
Entity. If you are in a position of leadership, even the Iranian press, even the Iranian media inside Iran is very careful not to use the word Israel, because the minute they use it, it bestows a certain legitimacy on the state of Israel as being Israel, being a country. A legitimate state. It's unrecognized as a state by the Islamic Republic. So they never use the word Israel. You would never hear Ahmadinejad say Israel. You would never see, I mean, it may slip once in a while out of their mouths, but they're not supposed to. I mean, it's a kind of unwritten rule that you don't say Israel. You call it the Zionist regime. And I find that, you know, whenever I've been in Iran, if I ever say Israel, people are like, you know, they're all, whenever they respond, they always say Zionist regime. They never say Israel back to you. They probably are afraid that I'll say. But whenever you translate, you know, you're just going to write Israel. You're not going to keep writing the Zionist regime. It also looks, you know, kind of strange for an American newspaper to write the Zionist regime all the time.
Yeah. Okay. So with that as background, lately, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
About attacking Iran. I'm wondering how you think that's playing in Iran. One question I particularly wondered about is, you know, from a strictly political standpoint, would an Israeli attack on Iran of the kind that you might expect, which is, you know, let's imagine one that's not assisted by the United States, it would be very finite, and it would be over. Is that something that would necessarily be bad news in political terms for the Iranian regime?
No, I'm sure that there are some people in the regime who would welcome it. I'm sure there are some people in the regime who would welcome it, because I think it would enable the regime to completely crack down on whatever civil liberties or opposition that's left after having spent 2 years or 3 years now cracking down on opposition or civil liberties. It would certainly rally a pretty large group of Iranians around the Islamic Republic's flag. It would demonize Israel in a way with the Iranian people that has never been demonized among the people, I mean, about the population. And I think that there are some people who would welcome that, because even on an international relations standpoint, the Iranian regime could then portray itself as a victim and go to the countries that have supported its nuclear program and say, look, you know, this is, first of all, it's illegal under international law what Israel did. There is, you know, we have a fatwa against nuclear weapons. So, you know, all the reasons.
Do you mean go to nations that have supported the sanctions against the nuclear?
Have either supported the sanctions unwillingly, like, for example, countries like South Africa that have been pressured into supporting sanctions by the United States, but have never been keen on the sanctions, and say, look, you know, and to countries that don't support the sanctions and say, look, we're the victims. I think the sanctions regime would fall apart. I think you'd find a lot of countries breaking the sanctions and willing to break the sanctions if there was an attack. So yes, I do think there are some people in Iran who look at it that way. But I also know that there are people in Iran, plenty of people in Iran who would not look at it that way, who would say, yes, it might be advantageous to the regime, but it's certainly going to hurt us domestically on a domestic level. Now, of course, I don't think Israel, if Israel is going to attack Iran, that it is going to be a kind of a Syrik reactor type of attack on one reactor. I think they will have to, even if they're doing it alone, I think the plans are for a rather larger kind of military attack, which would, you know, if they want to have any effectiveness, they're going to have to do more than one sortie, for example, against Natanz or Fordo, and it'll be a lot more involved. There may not be, you know, it may not be a month-long war or anything like that, but I think it's a more involved attack, and I think that it's hard to say what Iran's reaction would be in terms of fighting back or attacking Israel.
Okay, so let me ask you a little bit about Iran's nuclear program. I mean, I know you don't know any more about it than the average newspaper reading member of the public, but there is this issue of the enrichment of uranium. I mean, a big difference between Obama's position and Israel's position is Obama has said we won't let them get a nuclear weapon. He has not said we will not let them enrich their own uranium as part of a peaceful nuclear program. Although, of course, the Security Council resolutions do ask for a suspension of enrichment.
Yeah.
But as far as a stable, acceptable solution, Obama seems like he'd probably live with enrichment. Israel does not want to live with enrichment. They think that's too close to a bomb. Now, can you tell me why is enrichment so important in Iran? It seems to be a very important issue. They've insisted repeatedly on the right to enrich, which is consistent with the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, to be able to enrich your own uranium. But again, Israel's view is if you're so dead set on enriching, it must be because you want to build a bomb.
Right. Well, the Iranians reject that, whether you want to believe it or not. But the reason Iran started an enrichment program, or at least believe now that it needs to have a program, and there's a few things that we have done to prove to them that they need an enrichment program. I'll get into that. Firstly, they want to have nuclear power. They want to have nuclear power, nuclear reactors for providing energy. And the argument has been for now, 10 years, 11 years, to, at least to their own people, is like, France gets 60% of its electricity from nuclear power. If it's good enough for France, why isn't it good enough for us? Iran had deals prior to the revolution with countries like France to build power plants. After the revolution, those deals were unilaterally by the other countries. Those deals were broken. And in some cases, not even the deposit Iran had paid were returned. Iran has said, we can't trust the West to provide us with fuel if and when we build these nuclear reactors. Because we will be held hostage to Western demands for something else, perhaps, whether it's on human rights issues, whether it's on our support of the Hamas or our support of the Palestinians, if we need to get our fuel from other countries and we don't have an indigenous program that we have the ability to create our own fuel for these reactors. So they started off with actually a very small enrichment program, only 3.5%, which would be for a reactor. And it was really a pilot program under President Khatami. And under him, Iran did suspend enrichment while they were negotiating with the West. Khatami was here, that thing I was talking about, that trip I was talking about in 2006, and we had a dinner at the Iranian mission here for the Council on Foreign Relations. Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And at that dinner, I even wrote about it in my, I can't remember, my first or my second book. Khatami was no longer president, by the way, and Iran had started its enrichment program again after having suspended it for a couple of years. Khatami basically said, that Iran would be willing to limit its enrichment centrifuges to 164 centrifuges, which would never be enough to spin enough uranium to create a nuclear weapon, especially not 3.5% and then trying to get 164. So to have this like research program so that Iran would always have the ability, mm-hmm. if needed to, create its own fuel.
But the number of centrifuges is now well beyond that, right?
1,000. That was a deal back then that, in my view, and again, I'm not an Iranian politician, I'm not an American politician, I have no access to the White House. In my view, the Iranians felt that Richard Haass and the Council on Foreign Relations had a way to get that message to the White House. And there was never a response from the White House to that. There was never a response to this idea of 164 centrifuge is spinning, so the Iran could save face, and of course, the Americans could save face. At that point, the Bush administration's view was zero centrifuge is spinning. So now we see 7 years later, there's 11,000 centrifuges. So prior to 2009, in 2009, Iran was still only doing 3.5% enrichment. Right. Iran had gone to the IAEA, as it is supposed to do, when it needs fuel for its reactors. It has one reactor. At that point, it had one reactor, the Tehran Research Reactor, which provides, which makes medicine, nuclear medicine for cancer. It was running out of fuel. Argentina had supplied the fuel, which was going to end, which was going to run out in 2010. So they went to the IAEA as the, as a member state is supposed to do, and say, who will sell us the fuel? At that point, nobody raised their hands. Nobody wanted to sell fuel to Iran. So President Obama came up with this plan of, why don't you give us your 3.5% enriched uranium, and we'll give you the fuel rods for your reactor. Well, we know what happened. I don't want to get into the history of why that deal fell apart. It seemed that the Iranians first accepted it, and then they didn't accept it. And the Iranians claim it was always subject to going back to Tehran.
And ironically, the domestic politics got in the way, and the reformists kind of got in the way, didn't they?
Objected to that because he didn't object to the deal itself, and the reformists didn't object to the deal. So they felt that Ahmadinejad was making a quick deal with President Obama and giving away certain things that they would never have given up, such as they said, we don't trust France. Why would we trust France? The reformists were saying, why are you trusting France to provide the fuel rods when France has already shown that it's not a reliable partner? So they wanted to renegotiate it. So in January, Iran came back saying, oh, we want to renegotiate the deal. The deal's still basically there, but we want to, you know, we don't want France involved. We want to do it in Russia or whatever the deal terms they were. Hillary Clinton came back and said it's a take it or leave it offer. So then the Iranians and the Brazilians and the, at that time, the Turks tried to revitalize that deal, and they came back in May and the Tehran declaration that, yes, we made a deal. The Brazilians and the Turks claimed that Obama was in on it. And then, of course, a day later, Hillary Clinton again rejected that deal.
Slapped him down.
So then what did Iran do? Iran said, okay, you're not going to give us the fuel. We'll make it ourselves. So then they started enriching at 20%. So a lot of scientists in America, well, some analysts anyway that I read at the time, were like, oh, that's bluster. Iranians don't have the technology to manufacture these fuel plates, which is what they have to do with this 20% enriched uranium. And Ahmadinejad joked and laughed about that and said, we'll show you. And so, of course, they did. You know, a year later, they were manufacturing full fuel plates, and now they're installing them in the reactor. And, in fact, the latest IAEA report, which was a little bit surprising to some people, was that they have actually converted more than half of their 20% enriched uranium to fuel plates for the reactor. And that may be a political move on their part. I'm not suggesting that it just automatically proves that it's a peaceful program. I'm saying that may be a political move at this point to say, look, we never want this 20% to be for bombs. It's for, are they? So my point about enrichment is, this is very important to Iran to say, you have proven unreliable partners. The West has proven, if you guys don't trust us, we don't trust you either. You're saying you don't trust us, we don't trust you either. So as a scientifically advanced, technologically capable nation, and this, by the way, goes across party lines in Iran, it's reformist, anti-regime, pro-regime people. Most people in Iran still agree that Iran should have that capability. You can't be dictated to by the West what you can and can't do scientifically or technologically.
That is to say, an enrichment capability, not necessarily a weapons program.
Going to that, now we have this 20% enrichment, and now there's this chatter coming out of Iran that maybe we want to build nuclear submarines in the future, which would require 90% enrichment. If that would, if Israel's worried now, what do you think they'll be worried about when Iran's doing 90%? Which I'm not saying they're capable of, or you know, anything else, but at this point they're capable of. But so the enrichment is a very important nationalistic source of pride for Iranians, by and large, not all. And they've been willing to pay the price up until now. Now, things are getting worse in Iran, and I'm sure some people in Iran right now who are suffering under sanctions or suffering on, you know, a very weak economy might be thinking, well, let's make a deal. But I don't think very many people would say, hey, let's just give in to American demands. And so far, American demands have not been, or at least the demands that have been public, And the concessions offered have not been enough to make a deal. My own personal view is that President Obama cannot make a deal with Iran this year.
Before the election?
Before the election. It was always impossible for him to make a deal. There was no deal that Iran could accept, even that he could accept, but that Iran could accept, that he could get through in an election year, that he would want to even try to get through. So I don't think that's possible. I think the Iranians think that as well. I think the Iranians think that they just have to wait it out till November. All these negotiations with the P5 plus one and Catherine Ashton, I mean, they were kind of meaningless because there was never going to be anything that Obama was going to offer that was going to make the Iranians feel like they saved face. The only thing that Obama could, the only deal he could make is really kind of a zero enrichment deal, you know, and which would satisfy the political atmosphere right now.
Right, but given which Iran would not accept. I mean, that would be acceptable in America.
And unacceptable in Iran. So there was no deal before November. But I think they're based on, and I agree with you 100% that the President Obama has never said that enrichment is his red line, unlike George Bush's administration, which said enrichment, zero enrichment. Enrichment was a red line. And I think even Hillary has hinted that, you know, there could be an enrichment program in the past. She has, not recently.
She said as much in congressional testimony.
Yeah, so I think that is, assuming that President Obama is reelected, I think that is the basis on which they will try to solve this nuclear issue, as long as in the meantime Israel doesn't attack. Because if Israel attacks, you know, all bets are off. My own view is that if Israel attacks, the minimum that Iran will have to do is withdraw from the NPT. And they would do it legally. They would give the 6-month notice. They wouldn't like kick out inspectors tomorrow. They would do it so that they could be, you know, squeaky clean when it comes to the IAEA. Say, we're just doing it legally. 6 months, we have 6 months to withdraw. And from now on, you know, no inspectors, if they're attacked. But so I think that if we get through this period through the election, and assuming Obama wins, I think that, you know, that's my assumption. It may not be a good assumption, but it's my assumption. I think that you'll see that President Obama would like to put this issue to bed. And I think it's not that difficult to put it to bed.
And do you think there's definitely a reachable deal in terms of the Iranian politics that they would absolutely go for a deal that guaranteed them enrichment, tightly monitored, to make sure that they didn't approach weaponization in exchange for ending the sanctions?
And they've already said they'll go for the step by step, not even ending the sanctions all at once. They've already agreed with the Russians that we'll do a step by step. Let's say we stop 20%. They don't need to do 20% right now. Right now, the 20% is a bargaining tool because they have made enough fuel, enough 20% enriched uranium for that Tehran reactor. So whatever else they're making is going into storage, or if it's not converted into fuel. So that's an easy bargaining chip that they can give up. They could give up 20% enrichment, at least temporarily. They could then, you know, I don't think they'll ever shut down Fordo. That's an unreasonable request as far as the Iranians are concerned.
That's a facility that's buried in a mountain, and so is hard to get to, especially for Israeli military capabilities.
The argument is that they're doing that to hide their program, and the Iranians say, no, it's not hidden. There are inspectors there. There are actually the IAEA inspectors there. There are cameras there showing exactly what they're doing. And they're saying, no, if you threaten to bomb our facilities, you can't blame us for putting our facilities in a bomb-proof shelter.
And Israel actually probably would have bombed by now if they were. I mean, you know, Netanyahu was much more likely to bomb, would be much more likely to bomb within a few weeks if it were a less complicated military mission.
Often it would be a simple matter of just sending bombers and just dropping bombs. Absolutely. And I think they would saying, well, that's the reason. Iran will not close Fordo, but I wouldn't be surprised if they would be willing to limit the number of centrifuges there, continue the additional abiding by the additional protocol or signing the additional, ratifying the additional protocol to the NPT, having snap inspections, and limiting the centrifuges in that little facility so that they would say, we always have this backup in case someone decides to attack us. It's a pretty small facility. It's never going to be running, you know, advanced centrifuges churning out tons of 90% uranium enriched uranium anyway. But it's kind of like an insurance policy. And I think that's a deal that the U.S. could make with Iran. And the additional protocol, I would go a long way to alleviating some of the concerns that Americans might have about what the new program is. Because if you remember, under Khatami, Iran signed the additional protocol,
which involves tighter monitoring mechanisms than are in the plain vanilla version of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Correct. And it allows for snap inspections, which this current does not. The plain vanilla does not. They signed the treaty, but the parliament never ratified it. Again, the reason they didn't ratify it, the parliament, they abided by it. They abided by the additional protocol during the last 2 years of Khatami's rule. But they never ratified it again because they were waiting to see what the P5+1 package at that time was going to be after suspending enrichment, to see what were the benefits that the world was going to give them. And by ratifying it, they would be stuck with it. So they didn't ratify it, and now they say, well, since we didn't ratify it, we're going to not abide by it anymore.
Okay. So you think a deal is doable? Iran would settle for something well shy of weaponization, but that's not the same as saying that they're not at the moment keeping open the option of weaponization, or that there aren't elements of the regime that actively favor weaponization, or that there haven't been specific initiatives aimed at weaponization. And there are these bits of evidence that have surfaced that have people alarmed in that regard. One is this, I guess this facility is it's Parchin or P-A-R-C-H-I-N, where, you know, they're not letting inspectors look there. And the fear isn't that there's anything going on there. It's that Iran is intent on covering up whatever did go on there in the way of testing as part of a weapons program. And there are various other things, I don't know, plans that they found. So it looks like they have at least explored this pathway, right?
Well, I would imagine that in the past they have explored this pathway. And I imagine that you're correct, that there are people in the regime, undoubtedly, who believe that they should have that option. And by the way, not just the regime, there are plenty of ordinary Iranians inside Iran who say, why shouldn't we have? Even people who are against this administration or this regime who say, you know, why shouldn't Iran have nuclear? If Pakistan has them, why shouldn't we? If Israel has them, why shouldn't we? So, yeah, I don't doubt that. I mean, the Parchin thing is an interesting thing. I mean, you know, these photographs that come out last week with, you know, a pink shroud over one of the buildings. I mean, come on, the Iranians are not. They know the satellites are running overhead. I mean, to cover it in a pink plastic tarp.
Yeah, I would go for earth tones myself.
I would have gone a camouflage. You know? But I think they were highlighting it. I think, it's another bargaining tool. Even Gareth Porter wrote about this. It's very unlikely that you'd be able to sanitize a site. There are scientists who say you can't fully sanitize a site. It's almost impossible to fully sanitize a site. The building doesn't look like the kind of building that could have been used for them anyway. And the Ukrainian scientist who was there said the same thing. So I think, you know, I doubt that they have ongoing or even in the recent past have had, because Parchin was visited, like I think it was 5 years ago or 6 years ago by the IAEA as a military site. And since it's not a declared nuclear site under IAEA and NPT rules, Iran doesn't have to allow them to visit it. Mm-hmm. So they're going by the letter of the law. And right now, I think the sense is, look, you know, the Americans are being playing hardball. You know, we're not going to be soft right now. We're going to play hardball, too. Each one of these things that we, you know, if we stick to the letter of the law of the NPT before we have some real negotiation, then these are things that we can give up. Why would we give it up now? Why would we let the IAEA go to a site when we're not obliged to let them go before there's even any discussion of anything, lifting any sanction, not even one sanction? So it's understandable from a foreign policy standpoint, from a national security standpoint of Iran to behave that way. And I wouldn't be so alarmed about it as some of the other people in America certainly in Israel have been alarmed about it. But it's pretty clear. And even the Mossad and our own CIA, I mean, nobody right now believes that Iran has an active weapons program. Intelligence agencies don't believe that it has an active weapons program. And I doubt that they do. But I would also agree with you that they can kind of, if you ask them the question, they can kind of smile at you knowingly and say, well, you know, that's just a, if we have an enrichment program, if we have missiles, if we have this, if we have that, the effect is that effectively we are a nuclear power and we could potentially.
Well, exactly. And that's a point worth making is that, you know, if you ask, well, why isn't Israel willing to live with what we've just described, where they have enrichment, but it's part of a peaceful program and it's monitored to make sure it's only enrichment. Well, you know, there is this thing called breakout capacity, and that can be another way of describing it. And breakout capacity means that you could within a matter of months or whatever. It would depend on the exact status of the enrichment program, how many centrifuges, and what deal you agreed on. But the way Israel would view it is, you know, if they're enriching and have a fair number of centrifuges and they you know they've got some weapons know-how, we consider that breakout capacity. We consider that.
I don't disagree, but I think that Israel has to live with that, unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't think they have a choice, because you can't stop Iran at this point from having breakout capability at some point in the future, whether it's now. You're not going to stop that. You're not going to bomb their knowledge out of them unless you kill every single scientist they have, unless you kill their, you know, everybody who has any, the remotest students, nuclear science students at universities. You're not going to bomb that knowledge out of them. That's not going to happen. The only argument you could feasibly make is that the only way to ensure that they don't ever have, or not even have, or that they, even if they have breakout capability, they never pose a danger to Israel under any circumstances, is regime change. That's the only thing. And then it would have to be a regime change, not on the order of, you know, the Arab Spring, where a popular regime change, it would have to be an imposed regime change, a client of the United States or a client of Israel.
We know how well that works out.
We know how well that works out, yes. So I think, I mean, even Iraq, which is a sort of imposed regime change, even that hasn't worked out, let alone, you know, if you try to do something even more overtly, overt regime change. So, I mean, realistically, I just think that, and I think Israelis recognize this, that there isn't a choice. The choice is really, and it's less about Israel, actually, as it is about the United States. The United States has the ability, as the world superpower, as a country that is needed economically and in many other ways by other countries, at least on a trade level. China needs us, for example. Iran would like to have us, I think. That the U.S. has the ability to disincentivize Iran from ever taking that step, regardless of what the regime is. Let's assume that, you know, 5 years from now, the Islamic Republic isn't there, or it's there in a different form, a reformist form that's much more benign, much less, you know, heated rhetoric coming out of Iran, less of a danger. Even they would need to be disincentivized from taking that step and building a bomb. And I think it's possible. I think it's possible to disincentivize them. But you're not going to disincentivize them by imposing harsh sanctions on them continually, threatening to bomb them. If anything, all these threats and these sanctions are saying, you know what, maybe if we built a bomb, if there's an Iranian leader today whispering in the Supreme Leader's ears, and they all do, by the way, he has meetings all the time with different people from different political factions saying, you know what, those guys are saying give in, forget about it. We actually should be building a bomb today, because if we test a bomb and build a bomb, then effectively the sanctions are meaningless. We will then be in a position to demand, you know, many, many things. Or we have nothing to lose. Let's just do it.
And do you think there's no point at which a kind of a sticks-only approach, you know, as opposed to sticks and carrots? And there is this view among some Americans and no small number of Israelis that that's what you focus on. You yeah. threaten military action and you impose sanctions and eventually Iran will surrender. Is it your view that there's really no point at which the sticks-only approach will there's work? No,
Iran will not surrender. This government will not surrender.
Yeah, but of course the scenario is eventually there will be enough. There will be riots in the streets or something for lack of food. You know that the regime will fall.
I don't think that's possible. I don't think in this world today it's possible for the regime to fall because of, you know, sanctions against it or that there'll be riots on the street. I really don't think so. I think the regime is...
So, I mean, is it that you think that the regime just has the means to keep things from getting so desperate that they would face revolt? Or is it that you think that the fact that the sanctions are a form of external pressure would tend to rally people around the regime and lead them to endure whatever the consequences are, or both or neither?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think it's certainly that the regime has the ability and it has friends and it you know, it can still sell its oil, as has been evident. And it still has, you know, huge foreign currency reserves and gold reserves, et cetera, et cetera. And I just don't think in today's world, you know, and I hate to use that word, interconnected or whatever, I don't think it's possible to isolate a country as Iran as much as we would like to isolate them. So you have that. I'm not saying the people will rally around the regime because of sanctions or because of difficulties. I think that the regime is certainly making its best effort to convince people that this is an attack. This is a soft war by the West and everything. And I think it resonates somewhat. I think people expect the regime to be somewhat in a compromising mood, at least to be able to do something. But I don't think they would be willing, or that if the only way to alleviate the suffering of the people under sanctions would be for Iran to completely give in, just surrender, raise the white flag and say, whatever you say, I don't think that would get a lot of support from the people. I think the people would it would be the opposite. Plus, let's assume for a moment that I'm wrong and that the Israeli view is right, that this all sticks will force the people, people will start being hungry and start rioting on the streets. And that would lead, then you're talking about leading to a popular revolution. A popular revolution would mean people would say, just do something for me. But that doesn't mean do whatever America wants. Even if the regime did fall, it would still be replaced by a somewhat nationalistic, I think, regime. Mm-hmm. And the history of Iran, you have to look at the last 100 years, really, and not just the last 30 years, and look at the numerous attempts Iran has made over the last 100 years for a form of democracy, constitutional revolution, Mossadegh 1953, the Islamic Revolution that in many people's view went wrong, wasn't a just revolution, or was a just revolution that went bad, and the Green Movement. I mean, one after another, Iran has tried to have this democratic rule, has tried to be independent of colonial powers back then in 1906 and then in 1953. And I think you have to look at the history of Iran as a nation state that's been there for 2,000 years. It's not a made-up country. People are very nationalistic, have a lot of pride in their 2,000-year history, a multi-ethnic society. People talk about, we can even split off the Kurds and split off the Arabs and the Turks, the Azerbaijanis. Well, that's also a pipe dream. There's no question there are separatist Kurds in Iran, but Ahmadinejad's number one vice president is a Kurd. The supreme leader is a Turk. I think the nationalism in Iran has it's different from countries like Iraq, where the Kurds of Iraq, how could they feel a part of a country, an Arab country called Iraq? They can never feel a part of that country. It's a made up country that's only been in existence for 70, 80 years, whereas the Kurds in Iran, I'm not saying there aren't separatists. There are separatist Kurds there too, and they would love to see a Kurdistan. But by and large, Iran doesn't have the ethnic problems that some of the Arabs had. So the nationalism runs deep, and this desire to have a democracy, and not just a democracy, but also to be independent, an independently powerful nation. And maybe it's a little bit of the romantic notion of the glory of the Persian Empire, two Persian empires, a pre-Islamic empire and a post-Islamic empire many, many years later in the 16th century. Maybe it's that memory. Maybe it's our poetry. Maybe it's our history books that tells us that we are this great people. And maybe it's undeserved, but nonetheless, it's there. It's there. And I don't see, quite honestly, the Western sticks up only approach working in any way. And it's certainly the only thing it's been doing so far has been strengthening the regime, at least in terms of its domestic component, vis-a-vis an opposition, vis-a-vis people who want to bring about change. It gives them the perfect excuse. Every time, people say anything right now against the regime, the Supreme Leader says this all the time. Ahmadinejad says it all the time. You're playing into the hands of the West. Even if they don't call you a Western agent or a CIA agent, you're playing into the hands of the West. We have to be united now. There's this war going on, an economic war, a soft war going on. I mean, it leaves no room for civil society. None.
Okay. So you think, that a deal that would stop Iran short of weaponization, and verifiably so, is eminently doable if Obama is reelected, eminently doable shortly after the election?
Not this year. I mean, I'm assuming sometime in 2013. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's doable if Romney becomes president, if he chooses to do so. I don't think
he will be under more political pressure not to, in part because, leaving aside any obligations he'll have incurred with regard to funders and so on, he'll be a first-term president.
Yes.
And that,
with Iran as a priority.
Right. This makes me wonder, there's been some speculation as to why Netanyahu has lately been seeming so close to clinically insane, right? I mean, he's just going berserk, and I wonder if really And look, he knows that Iran is not, you know, 3 months away from a nuclear weapon or something. He knows that. And I wonder if what he feels they are is 3 months away from a deal that would, or 4 months or 5 months, that would leave them with an enrichment capability. And he wants to do whatever he can to disrupt that, include possibly preventing Obama from being elected. I don't think
Netanyahu is in a position to prevent Obama from being reelected, if indeed Obama is going to be reelected. I think he knows that. I think if he starts a war right now, I don't think it negatively affects on Obama. If President Obama doesn't full force join in the attack, or the day after go in and join in, I honestly don't think it's going to make that much of a difference. I think he knows that. Maybe that's why he's acting a little insane, is that he knows there's very little he can do. It also may be that he realizes that Obama in all likelihood will be reelected, and he's going to face a president who's not going to be very happy with him, who's not going to feel a closeness with him.
But Netanyahu is not acting like somebody who is assuming Obama will be reelected. He's paving the way for a very tense relationship.
And even a difficult time for himself in terms of his own political
right.
In Israel. I agree. I don't understand it. Maybe he needs to up the dosage.
Okay. Let's
put it this way. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know Netanyahu. I've never met him. The rhetoric that is now coming out, even this like direct attack on Obama about the red line deadline thing today, which I read about in Haaretz. I mean, that just seems a little crazy to me. It doesn't make any sense.
I don't totally get it. Thank you for doing this. Quickly, before we go, you want to say anything about the book you're working on, or are you superstitious about that? This would be the third in your Iran trilogy?
Yeah, third in my Iran trilogy, yeah. This book, I spent most of last year, 2011, living in Iran. So it's really, it's not an overtly political book. It's really more about what it's like to live there, what it's like to be there, as both an Iranian and as an American. But I actually never lived in Iran. I left Iran when I was 8 months old, a baby. My father was a diplomat, so it was, you know, I grew up in actually mostly the United States. And so this was at an advanced age and a time to go back. And it was an interesting year last year. I think this year is also an interesting year, as most years are in Iran. But my point was to spend a year in Iran, and now that this book is really, I wouldn't want to call it a memoir, because a memoir indicates it's a very personal book, but it is personal too, much more than the other two books. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't really call it like a third book in that trilogy. The first book was much more social, about Iranian culture. And the second book was very political, coming right after the Green Movement in 2009. And this one's like a little bit of both. The politics are there, the culture is there, but also the personal experience is there too. That'll come out next year.
Oh, okay, good. So you must be very close to finishing it off. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And thanks again for taking the time. Been very, very illuminating.
It's great. It was a lot of fun. Thanks, Bob. Take care.
Bye-bye.